Welcome to the final furlong here on The Hard Shoulder. We are going to bring you between now and 7 o'clock all the way homeo at the end of your working week, hopefully. And we have a all-star panel for you. We have Lise Hand, broadcaster, columnist with the Times Ireland edition. The inimitable Bill Hughes, TV producer, Mind the Gap Films, and our US friend, well, really Galway friend, Larry Donnelly, law lecturer in NUIG and political columnist with the journal.ie. Well, this weekend, it's 1 year to the moment that Trump's inauguration took place. A little bit of a dispute of how many people were there, not as many as anticipated. But the great news for Trumpy is that Rear Admiral Ronnie Jackson, the official physician to the president, and I think he was Obama's physician as well, gave our Trumpy a clean bill of health on Tuesday afternoon during a White House press briefing. Have a listen.
In summary, the president's overall health is excellent. His cardiac performance during his physical exam was very good. He continues to enjoy the significant long-term cardiac and overall health benefits that come from a lifetime of abstinence from tobacco and alcohol. We discussed diet, exercise, and weight loss. He would benefit from a diet that is lower in fat and carbohydrates and from a routine exercise regimen. He has a history of elevated cholesterol and is currently on a low dose of Crestor. In order to further reduce his cholesterol level and further decrease his cardiac risk, we will increase the dose of this particular medication. The president is currently up to date on all recommended preventive medicine and screening tests and exams. All clinical data indicates that the president is currently very healthy and that he will remain so for the duration of his presidency.
Bill Hughes, is this not a cause of global rejoicing?
No wonder he's called a rear admiral since he's talking through his arse. But I mean, I never heard such nonsense. And so, and the pictures of, listeners who love Trumpy are going to be straight on going, there's Hughes with his anti-Trump.
And you've comrades here. Go on.
Yeah, it's just anybody with eyes in their head can see that the man is chronically overweight.
But didn't he do a cognitive test? And, you know, he's a really intelligent, bright guy.
What was he put up against?
He's a stable genius.
Did you see the cognitive test? I actually went and had a look at it.
No, tell me.
And, I mean, it is things like they show you three animals now and, you know, get you to name the animals. Now, if the President of the United States can't actually tell a rhino from a camel, we are in actually deeper doo-doo than we thought we were. I mean, it's a test looking for mild cognitive, you know, problems. Nothing deep.
All
it wasn't
right.
a psychiatric evaluation.
Okay. Well, it's anything. Superficial. But you were in the middle of saying that he's not healthy because he doesn't smoke or drink.
Listen, I'm a fat man. I accept that I'm a fat man and I accept that I have health issues. The pictures of Trumpy swinging the golf club with the tummy hanging out over the belt.
He's 17 stone, 7 pounds.
Yeah.
That's not a, it's not a, you know, he, apparently another pound and he'd be obese. What's a pound between
it's,
friends?
No, it's not fat, even the pound, it's the inch. It's the inch that's funny. It's how can he possibly have grown a couple of inches to be able to have the weight redistributed over a taller frame?
Well, what I actually think is hilarious is that immediately, as it does on social media, the girther movement started. It
began. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, it's a play on the birther, on his birtherism and birther movement, whereby he claimed that President Obama was born in Kenya and not in Hawaii and therefore wasn't eligible to sit in the White House. So, of course, they jumped on this and it was now called girther, the girther movement, because his girth was under question because the photographs were put up saying...
So what's the allegation here that he's got a kind of one of these, Bridget Jones kind of underpants to suck his belly in or something? What's the, you know what I'm talking about?
Well, I think I need to have a moment's silence just to, you know, to mourn the night's sleep I'm not going to have now because that image is going to be in my head.
Well, so, I didn't explain it very well.
No, you
but I meant
didn't.
A corset.
No, I mean,
thing.
It's just that, you know, the internet was immediately full of photographs of, you know, full length photographs of President Trump, you know, beside various people of a similar weight and height, saying there is absolutely no way that this could be accurate. This has got to be fake news. You know, the somehow they have managed to.
Think he's unhealthy? The cheeseburgers, the KFC.
He has to be unhealthy. I mean, to be honest, when I heard the diagnosis, I had to check that the Rear Admiral wasn't actually called Ronnie Corbett and not Ronnie Jackson.
Because, but he was Obama's physician. In fairness.
It was. In fairness. And I will actually say, in the interest of fairness here, that, you know, a few people came out.
Did Obama smoke a bit too?
Mm. Oh, yeah. He had the old crafty fag every now and then. But, I mean, he also played a lot of basketball. He ran. He actually took, you know, aerobic exercise.
That was just for the cameras, wasn't it?
And he looked positively undernourished
You know, I think the question has to be asked is how can this you know, Rear Admiral Ronnie Jackson, who did look after who was the White House physician since, I think it was 2013. And, you know, the language that he suddenly was using was more in line with the previous physician, Harold Bornstein, who, of course, said that he was the healthiest, Donald Trump was the healthiest president ever. And there seems to be some kind of weird virus that infects men of a certain age when they're confronted with Donald Trump, is they just start marching in step behind him and sort of throwing flowers, you know, before him.
As you do.
You know, it's an extraordinary thing.
I don't think you'll be throwing too many flowers, Larry. Tell me.
No. Lisa's fair point notwithstanding. I think this is an instance of people, and I'm one of them, who don't like Donald Trump latching on to anything possible to paint him in a negative light. And I think when it comes to weight, let's remember, this guy was elected president of the United States. When it comes to weight, I think none of us are in a position, least of all myself, to cast aspersions. And I think part of the reason why, part of the thing of his political appeal is, when he ran for president, a lot of middle-aged white men said, this guy actually looks like me. He could stand to lose a few pounds. He's there. He's capable, etc. But he could stand to lose a few pounds. He looks like me. He's somebody I can identify with, even if he's a billionaire, etc. And that's part of the appeal. So I just, you know, look, frankly, the doctor who examined him was somebody who Dan Pfeiffer, one of Barack Obama's top aides, said was a terrific doctor, somebody who looked after us very well. I think this is a non-story.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, I've been itching to ask you all this, because I know you're all anti-Trump, and I love winding up people who are anti-Trump. But I want to make a serious point. I chaired an investment seminar on Wednesday, and these are people who look into the future of the year, and all they're concerned about is investor money. The dollar, the Dow, equities, bonds, gilts, you name it. And they said a completely different narrative about big business and corporate America, and how they said to me, I want to tell you one thing, Ivan, Trump is going nowhere and business likes him. And they went on to go through the whole thing of where they thought that the dollar's down 15% year on year and how it's good for competitiveness. And then I see Apple, you know, with the repatriation of $31 billion, which actually means if you work out the 15% tax, they're bringing home to the States $200 billion of Apple's money to invest in the US. So Apple aren't alone. That money could go into infrastructure. Bad. I saw bad in Boston. Mm-hmm. I saw a shaky railway. Absolutely. I thought, my God, this is going to collapse.
Yeah.
And is there an element of which we're not seeing in Europe or here through the media, a purely business economic story that's more favourable to Trump?
I think there clearly is. I think if you look at the way the markets have reacted, if you look at the employment figures, I think that they are all favourable, notwithstanding the terrible sideshow that has emanated from the White House since Trump took office. That having been said, this is the difficult, tricky political tightrope that Trump needs to walk. In the first year, arguably, he is governed largely as a mainstream conservative Republican would. And that has left some of his supporters, the people who put him over the top, the people in middle America, that has left them somewhat adrift, even though a lot of them are sticking with him. If he carries through now on the promises he made, principally on trade and on infrastructure, that is, to put America first when it comes to trade deals, to rebuild American infrastructure, to spend an awful lot of money putting people to work, things that Democrats like me like the sound of. If he carries through on those, I suspect you'll get a different reception from those business people.
Okay. We're going to leave Trump there because we now have this. I have to tell you a little personal anecdote. In January 1988, my first child, Andrew, was born, and I had that in the car, and I played it about 400 times. I was so elated. But the reason we're playing it is a French mayor has made national waves by declaring that she will no longer give... how do you pronounce this? La bise?
La bise. Bise.
You do it so.
Bisous.
Oh, you're such an old romantic. Well, anyway, this mayor, anyway, says, look, I have to kiss 73 people every morning when I come into the office. I've got to do both cheeks. And this Gallic greeting kiss is all too much for this odd Picard wolf, the Lys. What should we scrap La Beast, or should we introduce her? Because people do so many variations of the air kissing and they don't even touch you. Then people come up and accost you on the lips. What's the right thing to do?
Well, I mean, from the point of view of herself, I think she's dead right. I mean, she's dead right on many levels. I mean, the amount of time that it must take to actually kiss 73 people once on each cheek, particularly in the flu season, it's probably not a great idea either. But let's face it, it ain't going to catch on here. Because Irish people just don't do that. They don't do that, the double kissing. You might get young ones, you know, in a nightclub to kind of doing the air kiss, mwah, mwah kind of thing. But really, on the day-to-day basis...
Well, Ryan Tubridy does it on the Late Late Show to everybody, mwah, mwah, both sides.
But he's sort of a national treasure and gets away with that kind of thing. Yeah. I'm not sure you would.
A what?
And I'm not sure...
No.
I'm not sure.
I'm not sure I want to.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not sure you'd be let. But, you know, it's I mean, I've seen the. I mean, I do remember actually once Ivan being massively amused when Brian Cowan was in situ in government buildings and Nicolas Sarkozy came over to. I think he came over to castigate us all about having temerity to vote no in the Lisbon referendum and try and talk us into voting the correct way the second time. And I was, you know, standing with the press posse and watching as they came out, as the two men came out and, you know, Brian was waving him off the premises. And, you know, Nicolas Sarkozy goes in for the bees. And I have never seen a more awkward looking man in my life. You know, I mean, Brian Cowan had to basically do the kiss, the French kiss. But, you know, he was the picture of awkwardness. And I can't say I blame him. I mean, you know, because Irish people and particularly
we're
Irish
not,
men.
This is not
we're just
for
not
us.
Fashioned.
Okay.
We're not.
Bill, you are a national relic. Sorry, I mean treasure. I mean, like, what's your attitude to La Beast?
When appropriate, do it. When not appropriate, don't do it. It's very, very simple. I mean, it's not.
But are you comfortable if someone does it to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Jesus, anything I'll get, I'll take.
But I think it's a lovely thing, is it then? In the arts, do they...
Oh,
like politicians, I think we agree,
yeah.
Not good at it, don't do it. But I think it, you know, it is a kind of thing that lovies do. And it's all fake.
There's a fakeness to it. But when I see close friends... I'm always delighted that we share a kiss on the cheek. That's just
oh, no, it's close friends and family.
Close friends and family,
yeah.
No,
but that's fair enough.
Otherwise, you see...
So this poor lady's going into work and she's 73
Well, I can't
colleagues.
Understand how she has to do that to all 73 of them. That to me is nonsense because when you go into an office and there's only six of us in the office, we all say, hi. Nobody's running forward to shake hands or kiss anybody. It's just, hello. Everybody's pleased to see everybody. Here's another working day. So to me, that's just nonsense.
But you see, apparently, the problem is that there is a whole etiquette around it and you know it's if you say kiss somebody you know a co-worker or whatever every day and don't do it the next day it's an insult and then the question is like what's that other co-worker done to annoy you you know and it might
there's
have just been an oversight
but there's an oversensitivity
so
there's
a protocol,
the line in the sand has to be drawn there has to be one day where you just say okay enough of this and it's the thing of you know antisocial behaviour orders the ASBO yeah well I always think there's a
tell
lot
me about
of,
your ASBO
no
yeah.
there's a lot of air kissing that goes on and I see that as an OSBO which is people approaching you and it's an over shoulder better offer where they're trying to look who else is in the room and to me that is an abuse of this but I love the old kiss
over the shoulder better offer.
Yeah right. You know that that's a politician
I'm trying
would
to think
that.
Of the hard shoulder and how we could work
a politician
that
politician would know that an OSBO.
First I never heard of it. What do they do in America? We're talking about a firm handshake, but and the other thing I want to say, because you're a tutor in a college, Laurie Donnelly, one of the things that I notice when I came in here and all these youngsters in News Talk in 09, they do this kind of nice embrace, like just say guy to guy, where they put their arm around you, there's no cheek contact, and it's kind of like a gentle hug, and I think that works well. Like, I actually was uncomfortable in the beginning, but it's kind of going, what do they do in the States?
Well, a lot of people in the States do that, and a couple of guys I would know for a long time, they did. Well, I was just home at Christmas, and a couple of guys did that to me. It still makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable, I have to say. I'm a fan of the good firm handshake. I'm not big on the old on a kiss or anything like that. I can only imagine, even among very close family members. For instance, if I went in to kiss my father, the awkward factor, never mind Cowan and Sarkozy, the awkward factor would be off the charts. So I think a good look somebody in the eye, not the over the shoulder, look somebody in the eye, give them a good firm handshake. I think that's appropriate.
Do you know, because I've done a lot of funerals in my day, back in the days of politician, there's a right way to do the handshake. If you really, what you do is you shake with your right hand, but you get the other hand and you grab their elbow. And it's that double thing and that intense look into it.
That was a Bill Clinton. There is an art to the handshake.
Yeah.
It's funny you say that. Bill learned it from me.
It's funny you say that.
No, my uncle was in politics for a long time. That was always his characteristic gesture to make somebody really feel like they were the subject of your attention completely, and you were their friend. That was the trick. You're not deep enough to be superficial, Ivan.
You're not
that kind of carry on.
No, there's a technique to it. I'm talking Final Furlong. I'm talking about the week that was. Lise Hand, Bill Hughes, Larry Donnelly are my reviewers and guests. Just before we go on to the next thing, I got into trouble. And Larry, it was my mea culpa. I misrepresented because last time you were on the show, I'm off to Boston. And would you believe it? It's minus 15. It's the coldest place in the world. So I said, you know what I mean? Well, we're bad enough here. Where it's perishing brass monkeys. But it's not as bad as Boston. I said, it's the coldest place in the world. All the texters wrote and said, do you not know? In Antarctica, it's minus 40. What nonsense you come out with, Ivan. But you corrected me. It was the coldest city in the world. What do you make of the weather lately? I think it's been awfully cold. There's a wind that'd shave you, Larry. So coming back here, I suppose you're not feeling a bit of it.
I'm not feeling a bit of it. The reason why is when I was in Boston, I've never felt anything like it, to be honest with you. I went out
this time.
I was just there just after Christmas. And on the 28th of December, as you say, Boston was the coldest city in the world. Not the coldest place in the world, but the coldest city in the world. And when I arrived, I went for a walk. My house is about a 5-minute walk to the nearest shops, etc. And I went for a walk to get the paper. And my brother said to me, get your gloves on. And I said, I don't need those. And so I walked to the shop and I walked back. And when I got to the house, I could put my hand in my pocket, but I couldn't move my fingers enough to get the keys out of my pocket. And I have never felt cold like that in my life. All I could do was bang on the door to get them to open it for me, because literally 5 more minutes and I'd say I would have been frostbitten. So coming from that extreme cold, which I've never felt the likes of, this certainly does feel cold. This doesn't feel anywhere near as cold, I should say. But certainly it has been cold. It's been a cold. It was a cold December, I think a cold January. And certainly for those of us who like to play golf, we haven't been able to get out at all.
And the West of Ireland has probably got the worst of it. Are you a weather wimp, please?
I love the cold. I hate
Do
summer.
You?
Yeah, I love winter. Yeah, I absolutely love it. Yeah, I love
Explain
an item.
Explain that rationale.
I have no idea. Maybe it's I was born in the middle of winter. I don't know what it is, but I'm actually much happier when it's cold. I totally wilt in the heat. I don't know what it is.
I know you're a weather wimp. I just know by that smile on your face, Bill Hughes.
I love crisp cold. Nice crisp cold. Number one, it tells me it's killing the bugs. That's the main thing. As long as it's killing all those nasty bugs, because we live on the river.
Well, is there any, sorry, carry on.
And the bugs, I know they're living Jesus out of us. So
In the summer.
In the summer, but also in parts of the winter where you have all these false starts to the winter.
Are you talking midgets here now? Kind of things that bite you?
Everything. Yeah. All little kinds of yolks that find their way into your living quarters. And I think this cold will just
I absolutely detest snow. I just, me too. It brings Ireland to
three
a complete
of us in that.
State.
Me too.
So as long as there's not snow, back in the day when I had yos and lambs and that, it really was grief getting them all in and all this kind of thing, and feeding them because there was no grass or anything like that. So what is your hated weather?
My hated weather is ice. Ice of any kind, because I can't bear the thought of slipping. And that's my big bugbear, and I have a phobia about slipping. So
no, wind and rain, because it just ruins the hair. That's what it is.
Yeah, rain doesn't bother me so much.
Wind and rain.
I think this country is actually very blessed, because when I was home, as I said, it was minus 26, and then in the summertime you get 35 degree heat. So having neither of those extremes to me, I think, is a blessing.
All right, we're going to take a short break there to gather our thoughts. But my Final Furlong panel are staying with me, Lise Hand, Bill Hughes and Larry Donnelly. We're going to deal with the issue of should all post-primary and primary schools be single sex, or Should they be co-ed? Some people have strong views. Stay tuned to The Hard Shoulder. Welcome back to The Hard Shoulder. We're meandering our way through the last week, reviewing it with what we call the final furlong. And my guests to do that are Lise Hand, broadcaster columnist with the Times Ireland edition, Bill Hughes, TV producer on Mind the Gap Films with Mind the Gap Films, and Larry Donnelly, law lecturer, NUIG, and political columnist with the journal .ie. Well, the next topic we want to touch on is single-sex schools. Labour Senator Eoin O'Riordan joined Ciara Kelly on Lunchtime Live calling for why we should abolish single-sex schools. All co-ed schools, have a listen.
About 17%, which isn't a huge amount, of Irish primary school children go to single-sex schools. That percentage would be much higher in Dublin. And then one-third of second-level schools in Ireland are single-sex education. So I think we really have to justify that. If we are continuing to separate children on the basis of gender, particularly at primary level, we have to justify why we're still doing that.
Larry Donnelly, you're an educator, a lecturer. What do you think?
Well, I suppose I'd make a distinction between what happens at third level and what happens, I suppose, at lower levels. I don't have a hard and fast view on this. I suppose I can only reflect upon my own experience and what that demonstrated to me. And I'm somebody who has a Catholic education. I went to a Catholic primary school, and then I went to a Catholic high school. The Catholic primary school was co-educational. It was boys and girls. I think I had a good experience there. What I will say is that by the latter years, however, there definitely was, we were getting 13, 14, hormones were raging on both sides. I think that there was a certain element of distraction that did come into that at that stage of education. I think that that's a reality, whether it's politically correct to say it or not. I then went on to a all-boys Jesuit high school, and I wouldn't trade that experience for the world. I think it was superb. I think that we were educated in a particular fashion, in a particular way. It was very good for me. There were efforts to introduce young women into the school, which I was opposed to, and most of the graduates were opposed to, and it didn't happen ultimately. But again, what I would say is, I don't have a hard and fast view on this. I think it depends on the person. It depends on the individual. It depends when children and young people are developing.
You are advocating some positives for single sex.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think that there are positives for it. That's why I would be absolutely opposed to Eoin O'Riordan's idea that it should be abolished altogether. I think it definitely is determined. It depends on the person. It depends on the young person as to
what are the positives.
Well, the positives for me in terms of as a high school student was that we weren't focused on for those 6 hours of the day, we were focused strictly on academics. And I'm not saying we're perfect. The reason I say that is because we weren't, you know, chasing girls. We weren't trying to – all these sorts of things didn't come into it. We were strictly there focused on academics. Now, I know the contrary argument to that is that doesn't resemble the workplace. That doesn't resemble real life, et cetera. I'm fully conscious of that. But at the same time, I'm aware that for a lot of us, having that experience, particularly at that awkward age, I think is really good.
Lise Hand, what's your take on this?
Well, I mean, I'm an ex-convent girl, so I was educated in a convent.
And a rock chick,
I know. I hope my parents got their money back, actually, having sent me to a school to acquire some manners and coming out with absolutely none. I would agree with Larry on one particular point, that I do think that you can't have a one-size-fits-all, because all children are very individual, and some children and some young people thrive in a single-sex situation. It could be to do with confidence. It could be to do with that they want, you know, they're very academic and they feel they can actually concentrate better in that. But on the other hand, I think that the disadvantage it puts them in terms of growing up in a mixed environment where they learn to deal with the opposite sex from an early age. So it takes the mystique out of it. I mean, I recall the occasional time a man wandered in inadvertently or otherwise into our school grounds. I mean, it was like a spaceship had landed from Mars and there was this like alien walking around the grounds. I mean, you know, there really was a disconnect. And I think a greater reflection of the problems that you come across in real life, I think the earlier that you introduce that, or should say, when you say real life, after school life, I mean, even take something like the controversy, recent controversy about Me Too and all that. You know, an awful lot of men have expressed sort of confusion about the rules of engagement and how one should disport oneself around a female. And I think if that's inculcated in young boys at an earlier age, that, you know, those rules are applied to the what's going on in the classroom, then I think it just becomes more natural. And I think that, you know, so
on balance, are you saying the state should produce? I mean,
no, I think there should be. I mean,
it seems to me that at primary level, we've no problem with co-ed. Mm-hmm. At third level, we've no problem with co-ed. It's this post-primary that you might be able to make some case for single sex. Is that fair?
I think I agree with Larry. I think there should be a choice. I mean, I don't necessarily agree it should be abolished. I think there are genuinely is a case that some young teenage boys or some teenage girls would thrive better in a single environment. On a personal level, I think I probably would have benefited more from being in a mixed school.
Okay. Bill, my take on this is I had two boys, two girls now in their 20s. The girls matured better. They studied better in this vital period. We're talking about sort of 13 to 17, 18 along there, up to Leaving Cert. And that it was in a co-ed school. But there are issues of laddishness and different issues. And it's hard to get the balance right. And maybe, like, I'm actually taken with Lisa's point, which is choice, parental choice.
Parental choice is a good thing in this instance. But you look at, there's a great book by William Golding, Lord of the Flies, and it's about young boys marooned on an island and how they resort to savagery. And I think a lot of young boys in all boys' schools resort to a level of savagery that they can never temper when they get to their adulthood. You look at a situation comedy on RT or on any television station at the minute called The Big Bang Theory. And you look at all these geeks who are geniuses in their own field, and they are understanding the mysteries of the universe and physics. The one thing they don't understand is women. And the reason they don't understand women is because they are constantly only exposed to an all-male environment. And I think the all-male environment shows a terrible breakdown of understanding across the gender divide. In the same way that you look at popular hits like Mean Girls and you look at how the female spirit can also be derailed by bad behaviour when it's allowed to just focus on itself. I think integration is the way forward, and I think integration will help us all deal with the social interactivity that has caused the Me Too problem. And I think that's
as you actually favour a state approach at that level.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, do you remember this?
The money from that Lourdes thing. Different thing altogether, Dougal. First of all, that money was just resting in my account before I moved it on.
It was resting for a long time, Ted.
Yes, but
a good long rest.
Lise, classic fudge there, Father Ted. An excuse of how money was in a particular account. A true story during the week that the UK, Her Majesty's Customs Revenue Service, Customs and Excise, released excuses that people had given online for things. I couldn't file my return on time as my wife has been seeing aliens and won't let me enter the house. I've been far too busy touring the country with my one-man play. My ex-wife left my tax return upstairs, but I suffered from vertigo and I couldn't go upstairs to retrieve it. My business doesn't really do anything. I spilt coffee on it. Have you any shameful blag of excuses that rebounded on you, or did you ever get away with it?
Oh, I tell you, you know, I think, like most Irish people, nothing strikes greater fear in me than when you open up the post box in the morning and there's one of those brown envelopes with a wee harp on it from the revenue. You know, I live in absolute fear of the revenue, and totally unjustified. I mean, I don't have any offshore accounts and I don't have sort of a secret second income stream.
We believe.
I'm telling you, I know, yeah. I want to say that right now and put that on the record.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, actually, the last November was my first experience filing my own tax returns. I've always been in the sort of a PAYE person until I went self-employed.
Now you've lawyered up.
And now, yeah, I'll tell you. But like every great journalist, I'm absolutely terrible on deadlines. So I was sort of idling in the house one day and I happened to catch an ad on the radio saying, file your returns or else. And I mean, I just went into this absolute tailspin. I was straight on to, I mean, I rang the revenue, I found a letter and I rang them and I was gibbering down the phone and said, look, you know, am I going to be, are you coming to take
you
me away?
You already sound dodgy.
And
yeah.
I know. And this lovely woman called Kira, and she sort of talked me off the ledge and said, no, you're grand. You can file it online. You've plenty of time. And I mean, I spent days in a blind panic before I got it done. And, you know, I think this fear of the, you know, of the revenue runs deep. I mean, you will recall back to the kerfuffle over the LPT, the local property tax, yeah, or the household tax. The government, the Fine Gael government, got absolutely nowhere with it. People were going, I'm not paying that bloody thing. And then they handed it over to the revenue run by Josephine Fehily. Exactly, the formidable Josephine Fehily. And as soon as revenue took it over, the compliance rate went from, you know, low 50s or whatever, right to sort of 98 more or less overnight, because people were thinking, I'm not having revenue poking around my affairs. Now, whether that's a guilty conscience or
whatever. So you've
whatever,
never done anything wrong. You've never had to have an invalid excuse.
No, I mean, I think my...
Dig deeper into your heart.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking back to my... Probably the closest I came to it was when I started off as a journalist way back in the day, and as a rock chick. And I was struggling to make a living. I mean, I was literally just, you know, trying to make a few quid. So I was signing on because I wasn't making a living. And I then acquired a rock column in the Sunday Tribune, and which was really cute, and I had my picture on it and all that. And I went in a Monday morning to sign on, and the lad behind the booth was sitting there reading the Sunday Tribune, and I could see my column with my picture on it. So I get up
and
to
you
the,
were signing on the door.
So I get up to the hatch and he's going, what can I do for you? And I'm like, I'm signing off. Thank you very much. And that was the end of that. So there endeth my attempt to, you know, to
so
basically
you've heard it live
the
on the Hard Show. I know. Dole cheese, yeah. Shamed. Ranker was right all along about that welfare fraud stuff.
That was it.
He was after his time. Larry, you must get lots of the dog ate my homework, do you?
Yeah, you know, anybody in the education business is used to getting lots of excuses. What I do have a sneaky admiration, not that I don't penalize them for it, but is a student who comes into me and says, look, I messed up. I went out drinking. I shouldn't have done it, but now this is the reason why I'm late with my assignment or I don't have it done. I have a real admiration for people who come clean, and I try to do that myself, because I think that most people, cynical as we all are, don't really buy excuses.
Bill, I'd say I think you should fess up here.
I'm like George Washington.
Oh?
I couldn't tell a lie.
Could you not?
If you believe that, you believe anything, Ivan. I don't know. I mean, everything from the dog ate my homework. I've tried them all. I've tried, you know, I'm a chancer.
We have one final quick topic. Take a listen to this.
Wake me up.
All right, we're going to leverage Trump, but it's really a wider story than Trump. Apparently, he says he only needs 4 or 5 hours sleep a night. But Maggie Thatcher famously said she only needed 4 hours a night sleep. And Obama said 5 hours did for him. Bill often called staff into the early hours. Is sleeping the key to success? You know, we have a lot of sleep experts, Lise, on this programme, and they say, actually, you need your 8 hours. My life has been transformed, no longer doing breakfast. I don't have this sense, oh my God, it's 5 o'clock, I should be up. What's your attitude to sleep? What do you consider enough?
I think it varies from person to person. I can do perfectly well on 5 hours as long as I'm not hungover. If I have been out the night before, I would probably need a good 7 to really feel human the next day. But I think, and I also thank God, I literally sleep like a baby. I don't mean wake up crying every few hours. I do actually sleep throughout the night.
And you get to sleep, and you, like, there's two problems. One, you can't get to sleep, or secondly, you wake up after 2 or 3 hours and you can't get back to sleep. You don't suffer from either of those.
Well, no, I mean, I'm literally asleep as soon as the head hits the pillow. And if I do wake during the night, I don't freak out. I mean, I either just turn the light on and read, or else I have discovered there's a very good app called Budify for anybody who actually does have trouble going asleep.
Oh. Mm.
Yeah, they do these very
Budify.
Nice.
How Budify. Do you spell that?
B-U-D-D-H-I-F-Y, I think
okay.
It is. And it's a whole series of different meditations, but they're not kind, you know, they're actually really nice
you're
ones.
You're chanting in the night?
No, you're not chanting at all.
The
they just talk to you.
The neighbours would be banging on the door.
No, they'd be well used to okay. Roaring and screaming coming from my place, you know. So they right. This would be
we won't go
fights.
Deeper into that.
Just
moving
fights,
quickly
Ivan.
On. Okay.
So that's, you know, but it's I think it's different for everybody. I mean, we know that Trump doesn't sleep because he's tweeting you know, all kinds of hours and nights, and we know he doesn't sleep.
The old adage, I think it was Bonaparte, said 8 hours for a woman, 7 hours for a man, and 6 hours for a fool. Or I think it's the other way around, actually. The 8 hours is for the fool and the whole thing is in reverse there. But what's your take on this? What do you consider a good night's sleep?
A good night's sleep would be 8 hours, you know, but I never get it. It's just not a reality of life, I think, at this stage. 5 or 6 hours is typically what I get. Unfortunately, I'd love to get more.
And can you perform well on that?
Reasonably well, I think, but it is. I wish I slept more. I wish I had more time to spend in bed. But you know, given the realities of modern life, I think it's very hard. And I think, especially if you have young children, one of the things my son says to me is, "Daddy, you always have bags under your eyes." And I said, "Take a look in the mirror, and you'll find out why." So even if you're staying up late, you have a child who's making noise in the morning, it's very hard to get 8 hours of sleep. But I suppose we can all dream of it.
And as one gets older, is there issue of having a cat nap? Against that?
I actually feel worse after I have a nap, to be honest with you. If I have a nap during the day and then I wake up, I feel groggy and I don't feel right. I'd rather hold off until the evening, even though I'm a bad sleeper. I'm not great at it. So I'm going to look at this app that Lisa's mentioned.
Bill, what's your take on this? And of course, if you have a reputation for getting up early in the morning, you can stay in bed all day. Are you a good sleeper?
I'm the 8 hours man. I am the 8 hours man. I used to be 4 hours, 5 hours, and that'd be enough. But as I've gotten older, I need my 8 hours.
I thought the opposite was the case. You needed less sleep as you get older.
No, I need my 8 hours, and I a good night, I will have my 6.5, 7 solid, deep sleep. And then the usual, you know, the nature call, and you have to get up.
Yeah,
you have to
get
all that kind of stuff. But when I go on holidays, the biggest treat I can give myself is a nap. I love an afternoon nap, regardless of where we are.
And is that a power nap?
Yeah.
I prefer to call it a disco nap. That's
disco
much,
nap.
Disco
nap. I would call it a disco nap.
It's the nap you have before you go out, you know, on the town. So
right.
It's at least it sounds more proactive.
It's like the extent of your debauched life.
There you go. Now. It suits.
You
the
have to
Spanish.
Have me back on more often.
It suits the Spanish lifestyle. It fits in with siesta.
You're dead right. You're dead right. Well, my sincere thanks to my Final Furlong panel, Lise Hand, broadcaster, columnist with the Times Ireland Edition, Bill Hughes, TV producer with Mind the Gap Films, Larry Donnelly, law lecturer at NUIG and political columnist with the journal.ie. My sincere thanks for coming on The Hard Shoulder this evening. And that's your lot from the programme for this week. My thanks to the production team, editor Mark Simpson, producers Dan Flanagan and Emma Cawley, researchers Kira Courtney and Steve Daunt. Off the Ball is up next. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening.